Good morning. It's a delight to be with you this morning. I look forward to the time that we'll have together over the next few days. I hope you're wider awake this morning than I am. I did not arrive in your area until about 10:30 last night down at Hobby, and that, of course, is not in your neighborhood, and so it took me a while to make my way up to this part of town and eventually get to sleep last night. So I intend to rectify that tonight. I'm not going to get up very early tomorrow morning. As Jeff has said, we're going to be thinking at this Bible study period about the relationship of those who are led in a congregation to those who are doing the leading, the relationship of a congregation to its elders, and talk about some responsibilities that we have as members of a group of people who are being shepherded or led by scripturally qualified men that are appointed to serve in that capacity over us. In Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 17, Hebrews 13 and verse 17, the writer says, "Obey those who rule over you and be submissive, for they watch out for your souls as those who must give account. Let them do so with joy and not with grief, for that would be unprofitable for you." The relationship of elders and congregations is like many relationships in life in that responsibilities flow in both directions. There are some mutual responsibilities that elders have to the congregation and then some responsibilities that we have to our elders. And ideally, both parties to the relationship understand their respective contribution that they are to make to that relationship. If elders are to rule, they have that responsibility. Those who are ruled have the responsibility to submit. They are to lead. We are to follow. They are to set an example, as they certainly are. Then we have some responsibility to take advantage of that example and to imitate them. If they are to teach, then we are to be willing learners of what they have to teach. As this passage teaches, those who serve as our elders, and we mean by that not just older men in the congregation, but those who are appointed to serve as overseers of the flock, they have the responsibility of watching for our souls. They have the duty to be on the lookout for our spiritual good, and for dangers that might face us, and to help prepare us for the difficulties that we might face in our spiritual lives. And this passage says they will give account for the watching that they have done on behalf of the souls of their brethren. Part of that is to warn us. The longer I live, the more impressed I am with the fact that warnings are an important part of life. If we are unwilling to be warned, there's just not much hope for us. Because there are so many dangers and difficulties that we will face. The devil sleeplessly tries to undermine our faith. He's going to try to destroy us. And there'll be times when we won't see the danger that we are in and need to be warned by somebody who does see the danger that we don't see. And if we are not willing to be warned, and there's not any of us who don't from time to time need that, if we're not willing to be warned, then the devil will have his way with us. And so our elders have some responsibility in regard to that. It's not all of their work, but they have some warning responsibility. And we are responsible for heeding those warnings. You know, in Ezekiel chapter 3, God talked about the responsibility of the watchman. In ancient times, when a watchman would look out for dangers, especially at night, if he saw the danger coming and he didn't cry out, then he had failed in his responsibility. But if he gave the warning and nobody heeded it, then the responsibility was upon them for having failed to take advantage of the blessing of having had a watchman looking out for them. So let me make some practical suggestions about how we could properly relate ourselves to our elders. I am not an elder. I have not ever served in that capacity. But I have worked with many sets of elders and have been a member of many congregations that were led by qualified elders. And so These will be just observations from my experience. You might could add to the list of some of these suggestions of things that you would think about. But these are some things, just very practical things, that occur to me that in most cases could improve the relationship that we have as those who have the privilege of having those who watch for our souls. At the top of the list, and this passage has already mentioned it, we need to submit to our leaders. This verse says, and I'm reading from the New King James, says, "Obey those who rule over you and be submissive." It uses two terms there in the original language. The first, where the King James translates it, "obey those," is a word that meant to be able to be persuaded, to be easily persuaded. It's the same word that's used in Luke chapter 16, verse 31, where in the prodigal of the rich man and Lazarus, the rich man, after he went to a place of torment, begged that somebody could be sent to warn his brothers who were still living, and it was said to him that if they wouldn't listen or be persuaded by the prophets, then they wouldn't listen even if one came back from the dead. And that's the same word that's used here in Hebrews 13, verse 17. To speak of our ability to be persuaded. And so he says we need to yield, be pliable, be those who are capable of being influenced by somebody who needs to influence us. And he says, be submissive. That literally means to cease fighting, to give way under, to allow yourself to be subordinated to someone over you. And it's not a coincidence, is it, that the Lord's people are compared to sheep in a flock rather than goats? I don't know how much experience you have with sheep or goats, but goats are not nearly as easily led as sheep are. Goats are stubborn, and you almost have to drive them to do what they need to do. Sheep, more willing to be led, and that's the way we need to be. Sheep. Not goats, those who can be led, who are willing to be influenced in a good direction. When we identify ourselves with a congregation, we place membership, as we sometimes put it, a part of that is that we are voluntarily placing ourselves under the oversight of that congregation's elders. I believe it's implicit in the agreement when we identify with a local congregation that we are saying, yes, I agree to submit to the leadership of this group of the Lord's people. And I agree to work cooperatively, not to be stubborn and hard to lead, but I agree to submit. I agree to be a person who, when I need to be warned or persuaded or taught, I will be easily warned or persuaded or taught. Romans chapter 12, Paul is one of several places where Paul compares the Lord's people to a body, you know, a human body that's made up of different parts that all have different functions. Romans 12, verse 4, he says, "As we have many members in one body, but all the members do not have the same function, so we, being many, are one body in Christ, and individually members of one another." Well, it's obvious, isn't it, you know, carrying out this illustration of the body, that if the right hand is unwilling to take orders from the central nervous system, or if it's fighting against the left hand, if there's opposition in the body, and the parts of the body are not willingly working together, then the body's got a problem. And so submission to our elders means, in part, submission as a part of the body, just one part, to work cooperatively with the other parts of the body, but also to the leadership that God has given to that body. We are to agree to defer to the good judgment of qualified elders. And I've used that expression deliberately, to yield to their judgment. If it's a matter of scriptural law, then elders have no authority to legislate in matters of scriptural law. That's God's prerogative. The only authority elders have is in the realm of judgment. And that's true of leadership, whether it's in the home or in the workplace or in the local congregation or in government or anywhere. When someone is placed in a position of leadership and given the prerogative, the responsibility of making judgment calls on behalf of those under their leadership, it's the responsibility of those being led to yield to the judgment of those men in a decision-making role? What'd be some specific areas where that would come into play? Well, in the use of the talents and the abilities that we have, our elders ask us to, in their judgment, here's a part you can play. We're asking you to do this in the local body. Why wouldn't I yield to that? Why wouldn't I yield to their judgment? That they feel that I'm able to do that and that they want me to do that and to say, well, I might rather sit at home and not do anything, but if you ask me to do that, then I'll yield to your judgment as overseers of the flock. If that's how you want my talents to be used, then I will yield to your judgment. Participation in work assigned. The shepherd says, Gary, here's what we want you to do this quarter. Here's the class we want you to teach, or here's what we would like for you to do. Why wouldn't I yield to the leadership of my elders in regard to that? And why wouldn't I yield? Why wouldn't I yield to the judgment of my elders who say, Gary, we request you to be here at all of the services of this congregation. Not just Sunday morning, but Sunday night and Wednesday night. We're asking you to do that. As your leaders, we're requesting you to do that. Why would I not do that if for no other reason than my elders are asking me to do that? Who watch for my soul and are looking for opportunities for my spiritual growth and ask me to do a perfectly scriptural thing that will help me spiritually, why would I not yield to my elders' judgment in that matter? Obviously, we please the Lord by doing that. If our elders say, here, congregation, here are the times during this week when we ask the members of this congregation to assemble. A part of submission to congregational leadership is yielding to the request of our elders when they say we want the congregation present to worship and to be taught. Those are just examples. There would be two extremes in regard to submission. There'd be the extreme of the person who doesn't submit at all. And he says, you know, it's none of the elders' business what I do. They don't have any right to ask me to do anything that I don't want to do. That rebellious attitude. On the other extreme would be just blind submission of the person who says, well, you know, the elders have total responsibility for my salvation, and so I'll just wait for them to tell me what to do. Obviously, if your elders request you to do something that would be sinful, you'd have the right to respectively say, no, I can't do that. To have the attitude of the apostles in Acts 5, verse 29, when they were told not to preach in the name of the Lord anymore, and they respectfully said, we'll have to do what God says and not what you say about that. But somewhere between that extreme of rebellious no submission at all and then just blind submission as if they were responsible, you know, for our salvation, somewhere in there is the healthy attitude of submitting to leadership. And that's just as much true in the congregational relationship as it is in any relationship in life where God has instituted some authority. If you have the thought, whether it's in the home or in your workplace or in the government or in a school or in the congregation, with respect to any godly appointed leadership, if you have it in your mind that you don't have to do anything except what you want to do, then I wouldn't want to be an elder trying to lead you to heaven. Submission to leadership is very important. No less important in the congregational relationship than in any other relationship. True submissiveness it's willing, for one thing. When Paul wrote to Philemon, making a request, he said, I would much rather, though I have the authority to command you to do this, he said, I'd much rather you do it willingly. Paul implies, if I have to, I'll command you to do it, but I'd prefer that you do it willingly and respectfully. When we yield to leadership, we're not just to do it grudgingly, but with a respectful attitude. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4, Paul talked about those who would be qualified to serve as elders, must be one who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. See, there's a difference between submission and submission with reverence. To be qualified to serve, a man must have shown in his own home that he has the ability to call forth reverent submission rather than rebellious, resentful submission. His own children must have demonstrated that he's the kind of man who calls for that kind of submission and who deserves it. And we are to emulate that man's children in a certain sense in the way we respect his leadership in the local congregation. If a man is scripturally qualified to serve as an elder, then he will already have had to prove, as in his home, that he has that kind of respect and that it will be a delight to submit to him when he exercises his judgment in regard to the good of the congregation. And men who have that kind of integrity, that kind of godliness, that kind of leadership, which is basically the leadership of a family rather than a business corporation, a man who has that kind of leadership ability rarely will have to demand compliance. All it will take will be a respectful request on his part, and those who are under his leadership will delight to submit to his judgment. Sheep that don't have any shepherds are in danger. It's a blessing, not a curse, to have godly men to whom we may submit in the Lord's work. And if you remember back here in Hebrews 13, verse 17, he says that we've got some responsibility to relate ourselves to our elders in such a way that their work will be a joy rather than a burden. Let them do so with joy and not with grief, for that would be unprofitable for you. So let me just ask you, everybody in this congregation related themselves to your elders the way you do, how happy would your elders be? Is the way you submit to them, is that a part of their joy, or are you a grief to them? So, submit to our elders. Secondly, I would suggest that we are to exhort them. To exhort means to appeal to someone to do what's right. There will be times when elders will need to be corrected. How do you go about correcting a leader? When you surmise that there may be some possibility that a serious error has been made, what do you do about that? Well, you go about that differently if it's an elder in the local congregation or if it's your father in the physical family or some older person in life. You'd correct that person differently, wouldn't you, than if it were one of your peers or maybe one of your children. For one thing, there's a difference between rebellious murmurings and substantiated charges of wrongdoing. Unfounded charges and idle rumors against elders are everywhere. You just don't have to go very far to hear people complaining about some things that elders have done. Most of it, unfounded, nothing more than rumor, not substantiated. And probably that's because leadership calls for criticism. If you've never been in a leadership position, you may be unaware of the fact that if you do anything as a leader, you're going to be criticized. Not everybody is going to agree with everything that's done. And the longer you've served as an elder, the more critics you will have. I once was a part of a congregation that we lost our eldership as a result of one of the two men resigning, but we had other men in the congregation that were qualified and should have already been appointed, so we hastily had to reappoint an eldership, and the man who had already been serving as an elder agreed to go back through the process to be reexamined again and have his brethren once again consider whether he was qualified. We had a hard time getting him reappointed. Even though he had been serving very faithfully for a long time, having served, he had his critics that he didn't have before he'd ever served because of decisions that had to be made. So the fact that there are charges against elders is nothing new, but the question is, are they substantiated? Who do they come from? Do they come from wise people or people who are just known to be rebellious? Is there evidence? Is there scriptural evidence? With any kind of charge against anybody, you consider the source, don't you? The source alone will sometimes cause you to disregard the seriousness of a charge, but particularly with elders. Paul talks about that in 1 Timothy chapter 5. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 19, where in regard to Timothy's responsibility as a young evangelist, he said, "Do not receive an accusation against an elder except from two or three witnesses. Those who are sinning, rebuke in the presence of all, that the rest may fear." So Timothy has some responsibility as an evangelist to point out sin in the lives of his elders just as he would anybody else, but that's to be done respectfully and very carefully, and no charge to be accepted unless it is well-founded with multiple witnesses. Even so, when an elder has truly erred, his brethren must exhort him. Do so respectfully. 1 Timothy 4, or chapter 5 and verse 1, not talking about elders in the local congregation, but just older men in general, Paul says to Timothy, a relatively young man, do not rebuke an older man, but exhort him as a father, and younger men as brothers, and so forth. And one time, when I was just out of college, my first work as a gospel preacher, wrote an article publicly rebuking a man, not an elder, but he was an older gospel preacher who was old enough to, at that point, to be my grandfather. And I carelessly suggested in this article that he was teaching what I believe to be false doctrine, and still believe it to be false doctrine, but I used the expression that he ought to put up or shut up. I had an older gospel preacher suggest to me that that might not have been appropriate coming from a man who was young enough to be this fellow's grandson, you know. He did need to put up or shut up in a scriptural kind of way, but that could have been said much more respectfully to an older man. And so when an elder needs to be exhorted, if you think he's guilty of even some sinful wrongdoing and you're going to try to help deal with that, deal with it as respectfully as you can. If necessary, disciplinary action will sometimes need to be taken against elders. I've known cases where elders had to be withdrawn from by the congregations that they were members of. But again, that would be done respectfully, as we would our own father in the flesh if he were the one in error. But what about helping our elders? You ever thought about the fact that you can really help your elders in this congregation? You can help them, number one, by praying for them. How regularly do you pray for your elders? And I don't mean just to pray for them to see things like you do. I mean, pray for the Lord to help them in this difficult work that they have. It just irritates me when I hear people say in any kind of a difficult situation, well, I guess all we can do now is pray. As if, that, you know, that's not going to accomplish anything. And we're down to not being able to do anything, so I guess we could just pray. Well, no, prayer is the number one thing. That's at the top of the list. That's always the most powerful thing we can do. So pray for your elders. You can help them by being patient with them, cutting them a little slack, allowing them time for growth in their own work. You can help them by restraining your lips from gossip. Zip your lip when you are tempted to gossip about your elders. And it takes more than an average honest person to see when that's what I'm doing is gossip. But that needs to be restrained. Encourage your elders. When's the last time you said an encouraging word to any of your elders in this congregation? I mean something specific. I appreciate that you did that. I encourage you in the work that you do. Let me know how I can help you. Support them. Endorse them. Give them constructive input, feedback that will help them in their work as elders. Openly communicate with them. And the simple maintenance of peace in the congregation is a big thing that you can do to help your elders. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 13, Paul says, "Esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake, and be at peace among yourselves." I think it's not a coincidence that he puts those two things just back to back. Esteem your elders very highly in love for their work's sake, and be at peace among yourself. That's one of the major things that you can do to help your elders, is to do all you can do to maintain peace in the local congregation. Then I would suggest that we have the responsibility to our elders to judge them fairly. When any kind of judgment has to be made regarding somebody else's conduct, we are commanded by the Lord to be fair and just. Jesus clearly taught in Matthew chapter 7 in the Sermon on the Mount that anytime we're going to measure somebody else by some kind of a measuring stick, we'd better be prepared to measure ourselves by the same measuring stick. Never apply to somebody else a stricter standard than you would apply to yourself. And Jesus said in John 7 and 24 that we're to judge not according to appearance, but with righteous judgment. Is judge on the basis of what's really going on, what the real truth is, and that may lie a little bit deeper than what you could see on the surface. So dig hard enough to see what's really happening before you make your judgment or your evaluation of a situation. With our elders, we're often inclined to evaluate the job that they're doing by a much harsher standard than we would judge ourselves by. We're inclined to be very strict in judging how well our elders are doing their job, but when we're measuring ourselves by how good a job we're doing being led, we can use a pretty lax standard. Well, that's unfair. Judge our elders by a harsher standard than we are willing to be judged by. Let me give you some questions you could ask when you feel the urge to criticize your elders. Number one, considering the job that I'm doing as a member of the congregation, would it be hypocritical for me to criticize the job that somebody's doing trying to lead this group? Given the job that I'm doing, would I be a hypocrite if I criticize the job I'm doing being led? Would it be hypocritical of me to criticize the leader? Number two, if all the members of the congregation related themselves to the elders as I do, how difficult would the work of this eldership be? I tell you, there's some people who are so rebellious and so insubordinate and so self-willed that if everybody in the congregation were like that, the elders would resign this afternoon. It just would be impossible to lead a group of people like that. So what if everybody in the church was led like you are? How would that go? Number three, if there's a problem, am I a part of the solution or a part of the problem? Important question, isn't it? I lived in San Antonio years ago. One of our members was a professional chemist, and he said, if you're not a part of the solution, you're a part of the precipitate. Well, no, that's a different twist on that saying. If you're not a part of the solution, you're a part of the problem. Am I anything but an armchair critic, a Monday morning quarterback? It's always easy, isn't it, in hindsight, to see what should have been done. Much more difficult if you're on the line having to make decisions in real time and changing, fast-changing situations that are very complicated. Very difficult to make those choices. Am I doing anything when I criticize, but just after the fact saying, well, from my vantage point, here's how it should have gone? That's easy for anybody to do. Much harder to make the decisions themselves. Number five, do I know what I'm talking about when I criticize my elders? Do I really know what I'm talking about? Do I have the facts? I may think that I do, but am I really sure that what I believe is happening here, am I really sure that that's the truth? Do I know enough about the situation to make a responsible judgment? Or are there aspects of the problem that I may be unaware of that would significantly change my outlook if I knew those things? Number six, am I aware how much easier hindsight is than foresight? If you've never been in a decision-making role, you just may underestimate how difficult that is. It is not easy. I said it's easy after the fact many times to see what decision should have been made, but it's a tough job to have to make complicated decisions, sometimes with not much time to try to figure out what needs to be done. We just do the best that we can because something needs to be done. That's difficult, and we need to understand the difficulty of that job. Number seven, what price have I paid to see this problem from the perspective of my elders? I can see how it looks from where I sit, but have I made any effort at all to try to see this as they see it, to understand the matter from within their frame of reference and to empathize with their situation? How far have I walked in my elders' shoes when I think I want to criticize them? And then finally, and simply, are my criticisms just and fair? Am I really being fair in this assessment? We'll all draw conclusions, make decisions about how our elders are doing. But when we do that, we need to bend over backwards to be fair and to be just, and never to measure them by a standard that we don't measure ourselves by. Next, and I'm running out of time here, so I'm going to have to speed up. There are situations in which it would be appropriate for us to financially support our elders. I wish that that were a much more widespread practice than it is. It's interesting to me that most of the passages in the New Testament that talk about financially supporting somebody in the Lord's work are talking about elders rather than gospel preachers. Some of them apply to gospel preachers, so we know it applies in that situation. But 1 Timothy 5, verse 17, for example, says, "Let elders who rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in the word and doctrine. And then verse 18 is where he quotes, where the scripture says, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain, and the laborer is worthy of his wages. I don't know of anything that would help the Lord's work in more places than if we had some elders who would lay aside their secular livelihood and allow their brethren to support them, if possible, to spend their full time shepherding the flock. You don't think there's enough work shepherding this flock that could require the full-time effort of all of your elders if they would do that? Plenty of work and more that often doesn't get done because men are having to take time out from their shepherding responsibilities to make a livelihood. The same principle applies there that applies with gospel preachers. I couldn't do near the work that I do in gospel preaching if I had to, you know, work at Walmart as a greeter or something to make a livelihood. My brethren have said, let's provide your livelihood for you so you can spend all of your time doing this. Same principle applies to elders. Why cannot we say, at least to some of our elders, let us support you so that you can spend all of your time doing this? Look at the good that would come from that. Not to be cynical, but one reason that doesn't happen any more often than it does is by the time a man is old enough and mature enough to qualify as an elder, he's well established in a career that very often is so lucrative he would not think for a moment of giving that up in order to live at the level that his brethren could support him at. That's why we don't have any more full-time supported elders than we do. But look at the good that would come. If we would be willing to support our elders full-time so that they wouldn't be hindered by having to spend 40, 50, 60 hours a week in a career, they could shepherd us. Wonderful good things would come from that. And I appeal to the Lord's people everywhere I go to be willing to consider that. If not all of your elders, at least one of them. And if he won't be supported full-time, then what about part-time? Let's just have some elders who are able, by the fact that we're supporting them financially, to spend more of their time shepherding the flock. And then I suggest that we have the responsibility to use our elders. And I don't mean that to exploit them or to use them in a bad sense, but to take advantage in a good sense of the work that they bring to us by asking for their help and their prayers and so forth. James chapter 5 talks about calling for the elders when there's a problem that they need to be involved in, rather than just assuming that they're going to know about it and then criticizing them because they didn't come visit me when they didn't even know about the problem. We need to ask for the help of our elders when that's appropriate. When they need to be praying for us, let them know what they need to be praying for. Too often, elders are the last to know about things that come within the scope of their leadership. People assume that they know when they don't. So as a preacher, I long ago got in the habit, when people come to me and say, Brother Henry, do you know about this that's going on in the congregation? What are you going to do about that as the preacher? My stock response anymore is, have you talked with our elders about that? Well, no. Well, why not? They need to be involved. They're not going to be involved unless you specifically ask for their help about that. We can use them by imitating them. Hebrews 13, verse 7, you remember, said, follow their example. It's one way you can take advantage of the good benefit of elders is to imitate their example. Men unfit to be imitated ought not to be appointed. If they're qualified to be appointed, then they're worthy to be emulated. Great results would come from more time spent imitating our elders and less time criticizing them. And then by seeking their company and their counsel, learning from them, utilizing their potential to the full advantage intended by the Lord. You've got a great benefit here at Kleinwood, the elders that you have. Don't let that go to waste. Utilize them to their maximum ability. And then finally, we have the responsibility to respect them. They are older men, after all. Although I must tell you, it's considerably distressing to me at this point in my life that so many of the places that I go to preach, the elders are younger than I am. It's just not right. You know, the word elder means older man. But I'm telling you, back at Broadmoor in Nashville, Tennessee, where I preach, I performed the wedding ceremony for one of our elders and his wife when they got married. So, but for most of us, they will be older men. And that alone would say that they are to be respected for their age and their maturity and their wisdom. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 12, depending on what translation you're using, The New King James says, "We urge you, brethren, to recognize those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you." Is it the older King James that used the word know those who labor among you? The word there means to recognize in the sense of honoring somebody. It doesn't mean, it says recognize your elders. It doesn't mean that when somebody walks by, you say, oh yes, he's one of our elders. No, it means kind of in the same sense of the term as if say there was a banquet held to recognize someone for distinguished service. It means to identify them, to know them with respect, to give them esteem. And that requires a certain closeness of association with these men. Interesting to me that so many of those who criticize elders so unfairly are people who really have no personal relationship with them. They've never gone out of their way to try to establish a close relationship so that they could give them esteem. They criticize from a distance. Well, we need to respect them, and that involves coming to know them more closely than we sometimes do. I'll tell you this. Your children need to know your elders more than just to recognize who they are at the church building. Have your elders in your home. If you can, be in your elders' home. Make sure that your children have some opportunity to become personally acquainted with your elders. Won't be anything you'll do for your children that'd be any more beneficial than that. To make sure that your children have a close enough look at your elders that they're able to see the value of what they do and to appreciate them for their work. So back here in 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 13, he says, "Esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake." When we are cynical and skeptical and hypercritical toward our elders, that needs to be replaced with a wholesome honor. And I don't know you. This is my first time here, so I have no idea what your relationship with your elders may be. I hope that it's good. I always assume the best, and so until I see evidence to the contrary, I'm going to assume that you have exactly the relationship with your elders that you ought to. But I'll tell you, places where I go, there's not anything that's any more encouraging and refreshing to me than to see brethren who respect and love and honor their elders. It just makes me feel very good when I hear brethren say, "We have such good elders. They work so hard. We are so fortunate to have them leading us in the Lord." It's a tough job. And Paul says they're to be respected very highly in love for their works. sake. You wouldn't have to walk in their shoes but just a few yards before you would see how tough that is. And they are to be respected for being willing to assume the very difficult responsibility of shepherding the souls of other people. I don't know of any more important aspect of the Lord's work than this. If we've got a preacher shortage, we've certainly got an elder shortage among the Lord's people in our generation. That may not be true here, but it is true in many places. There's just too many congregations that don't have any elders. They don't even have two men in the congregation that would be scripturally qualified. And what a sad commentary that is on us as the Lord's people in this generation, that there are so few men who are scripturally qualified to serve. Ideally, you know, I'm afraid in our generation, we kind of take it for granted when somebody says, "How many elders should we have?" Well, we should have all of them that are qualified to serve. As soon as a younger man becomes qualified, then he's to be appointed. Well, that's simply a commentary on our times. That says that we are so desperate for elders that as soon as somebody is qualified, then certainly he needs to be appointed. Wouldn't it be wonderful? Wouldn't it be ideal if we had so many men qualified to serve as elders that we didn't need all of them to serve? We would select from those who are qualified these to serve. That seems to be what's going on in Acts chapter 6 when those men who would later be called deacons were to be appointed The instruction was, look out from among you men who have these qualities. That implied that the seven that they appointed weren't the only seven that had those qualifications. Wouldn't that be wonderful if we had an overabundance of qualified men, and from those men we would select those who would serve? That would test those who weren't selected, wouldn't it? Have the right attitude about that, and not to get all bent out of shape because they weren't picked. If they're qualified, then they would be delighted for their brethren to make the decision whether they would serve or not. But what a wonderful thing it is when we have at least two men in the congregation. No scriptural authority for having just a one-man eldership, but when there are at least two men to serve as elders, as shepherds, they are asked by their brethren to serve. They're appointed, placed in that capacity, with that responsibility, and they do it gladly, willing to spend and be spent, and they have the love and the respect of those whom they lead. I just don't know of anything that has to do with our work as the Lord's people that's any more important, it's any more critical than what we've just talked about this morning. Having scripturally qualified elders and then having us properly relate ourselves to them, when it works the way the Lord designed it to work, it works beautifully. When it doesn't work as the Lord wanted it to work, trouble is never very far away. The Lord designed a beautiful system that works very, very well. And let's emulate the New Testament teaching that we have about what elders are to do and what qualities that they are to have before we appoint them. And then let's properly relate ourselves to them so that their work is a joy and not a grief. Okay? Well, I believe our time is almost up. Maybe I just say that all of the lessons that will be presented between now and Wednesday night will be lessons that our elders, that your elders, have asked to be presented. This will not be a meeting where I decided what to speak. This is a meeting where your elders plan the menu for you, and it's going to be challenging. When I looked at the list of topics that your elders asked me to speak on this week, I said, well, there's some bold elders who will challenge their members. This is not going to be a feel-good meeting that will send you away floating on a cloud. These lessons, the ones beginning tonight, will be part of a series that first time Paul Earnhardt heard it when it was originally presented many years ago in Louisville, Kentucky. At the closing service, he said, this has been a week of uplifting anguish. And so, I don't know when you've heard these lessons whether you'll put the emphasis on the uplifting part of it or the anguish part, but they're challenging lessons, and I commend your elders for asking for these lessons. That says something good about them, and it says something good about you that you want to be challenged. So I hope our time together will be well spent. Thank you for listening so much this morning.